In Western societies where the most basic notions of right and wrong are not only denied but actively suppressed, recovering a biblical and distinctly Christian understanding of the natural law is absolutely essential.
Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Traditionally, Christians have understood that man is not born a blank slate just waiting to be programmed like a machine. We are moral creatures whose imaginations are darkened by sin. Yet every person still has a basic understanding of right and wrong because God has revealed it to us in his creation through natural law. Denying the vital role of natural law has grave consequences, not only for society, but for the church's crucial task of proclaiming the gospel.
You can meet and hear Aaron Wolf making the case for natural law Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Column in The New Yorker recently asks and attempts to answer the question why it's become so hard to get an abortion. It's talking about parental consent laws, ultrasound viewing that's required in some states before receiving an abortion, calling those and other restrictions on abortion a punitive political strategy against women. Joining us to respond to the column, Scott Klusendorf, a regular guest, president of Life Training Institute and author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Scott, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Let's deal with the premise of the title first. Is it so hard to get an abortion in America?
Legally, no, because the federal courts have determined that no unborn child has a right to life at any time in the pregnancy, and that any woman can abort any child for any reason or no reason, and in some cases, you see a push to have tax dollars pay for it. So legally, no. It is true that in some states, due to what's known as abortion control legislation, things like parental consent, cutting off of tax funding for abortion, ultrasound, spousal notification, those kinds of laws, which we call abortion control legislation, abortion may be more difficult or you may have to take more time to get it. But it certainly is not illegal to get an abortion.
This piece in The New Yorker, in some ways, kind of profoundly dishonest and misleading, and in other ways, at least in a small way, maybe refreshingly honest. This is what the author says near the end of her piece, talking about an abortion that she had. She said, "I never did feel that I'd killed a baby. I felt that I'd ended a pregnancy," but she does talk about ending some kind of life. Is she being completely honest on the real issue surrounding abortion, which is who is the unborn?
Well, I think she's ambivalent, but wrestling. And this is true of a lot of women I've talked to. There are some who have had an abortion, and they would have five more, and they think abortion saved their lives. There are others who say, "I regret my abortion." And then you get women like this, who I think are largely in the majority. And they are women who are trying to make sense of, clearly something was alive in there because dead things don't grow. And they're very similar to Naomi Wolf, who wrote that remarkable piece in 1995 called Our Bodies, Our Souls, where she argued that feminists need to admit that abortion is a real death. You have other feminists who are coming out, even ones who are unmistakably pro-abortion, who will say things like Camille Paglia said, that abortion is murder. And she says, quite frankly, "I'm not afraid to admit that. And it's not removing a clump of cells. It is extinguishing a real human life." In other words, we've got feminists now admitting that abortion is the intentional killing of an innocent human being. And that's a good start. At least there's some honesty there.
So let's talk about generally the author's description of mandated ultrasound viewing, parental consent laws as a punitive political strategy against women. How would you respond to that?
Well, since since when is it punitive for women to be given full information about a choice that they're about to make? Ultimately, the column is condescending to women because it's saying they can't handle the truth, to quote a famous movie line. I don't think that's something that you should celebrate, is women having great freedom and a great feminist principle that we're going to keep them in the dark about this. Why wouldn't you want to have all the information? And going back to that Naomi Wolf piece I referenced a moment ago, that was precisely her major thesis in this article, Our Bodies, Our Souls, that when we say women are too inherently weak to handle the complete choice or the complete truth about a choice they're about to make, we're actually speaking down at them.
She makes the point that many women who have abortions may have been pregnant before and carried the pregnancy to term. And therefore, ultrasound laws, that is, women's right to know laws that are common in some states, in her words, proceed, first of all, from the notion that women don't realize that in choosing an abortion, they will be ending some form of life, however they think of that life. What's your response, Scott?
Well, again, I find this kind of a strange thing. Just because a woman is pregnant in the past and now might be pregnant again doesn't mean the ultrasound information she could gain from a law wouldn't be helpful to her. We hear stories all the time about pregnant young single mothers who didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know what they were doing with birth control. And now suddenly we're just supposed to assume that they're masters of this whole process. They understand it fully and need no further information. I think our opponents are talking out both sides of their mouth here.
She speaks of mandatory counseling prior to or after an abortion. She says this is not informed consent, but ill-informed consent with a side of coercion. First of all, what's she talking about, and what's your response?
Well, what she's talking about is there are some laws where the abortion control legislation in play insists that the woman be given full disclosure about what the surgical procedure will involve. And she's calling that manipulation. She's calling that misinformation. Well, that's a pretty bold claim. Notice she gives no evidence of where we're wrong. I mean, the question I want to ask her is, you're so sure pro-lifers don't understand what abortion is. You tell us, what do real abortions look like? What do real abortions involve? She never goes there. She just makes this assertion.
Then she talks about laws that, whatever they may be, that have the intent of discouraging women from having an abortion, and then says, but they're failing. These laws are failing, citing a 2014 study about women who visited a Los Angeles Planned Parenthood clinic, were offered the option of seeing the sonogram. 98% of them decided to proceed with the abortion anyway. What are your thoughts, Scott?
Well, so in California, maybe that was true. Maybe that's true in LA or San Francisco, but it doesn't follow. It's true in every other state where abortion control legislation has helped drop the abortion rate. I'm not going to argue that these laws stop every woman from having an abortion, but they stop a lot in most states. And researchers like Michael New have done remarkable work demonstrating that abortion control legislation does have an impact and does help the pro-life cause.
She also cites the fact that most abortions are carried out during the first trimester. There's not a lot to see on a sonogram at that particular point. Is she right?
No. In fact, we have ultrasound technology now, 3D ultrasound technology, transvaginal technology that makes even the early fetus visible. But that's really not the moral question here. Imagine someone saying, you know, when it comes to rape, there's only a small number of women who are raped who happen to come from minority races. Therefore, we're not going to worry about it. That would be considered just horrible if someone said that. Even if you look at abortions after 12 weeks, after the first trimester, you're still talking about a huge number. You're talking about over 150,000 a year. That's not a small number.
Then finally, on the ultrasound laws, she simply asserts that it is a wedge into the private space of deliberation, that this is a violation of privacy, trying to inform a woman before she makes the decision to abort her child.
Okay, so now we're invading the all sacred god of privacy by making sure a woman is fully informed of the decision in front of her. Again, this is just condescending rhetoric from an author who sets out to claim to be the champion of women's rights and claim to be the great defender of women, and yet she treats them like they're these weak vessels that cannot handle accurate information. And by golly, if we give them accurate information, we're really conducting an act of terrorism upon their psyches. It's a remarkable piece. It really is.
If we were talking about some medical procedure, because I hesitate to call medicine, it's a procedure, but it's not a medical procedure. But if we were talking about some medical procedure and someone were writing in the New Yorker saying the patient doesn't need to know everything they possibly can before having this surgery, they don't need to know this, that would get in the way of them making the decision to have this surgery, it would seem ludicrous.
Well, and if a physician acted that way, he'd be subject to malpractice claims. But I've had surgery. I wrecked my elbow playing tennis a few years back when I still thought I was in my 20s and could backpedal on a lob the way I used to. And I had to go in for elbow surgery. And I'm telling you, I not only had a preliminary pre-op visit with a doctor a couple of weeks before the surgery where everything was explained to me in detail. He explained what he was going to do in there. When I showed up for the surgery, they went over it again and explained it and had me sign additional consent forms. So why should abortion be treated any differently?
And they informed you of the risks of surgery in general and of this surgery in particular.
They did indeed. Yes, they did.
So why does, before we go on to parental notification, why is abortion singled out as a procedure, and this is only performed on women, that seems rather discriminatory, where the patient doesn't need to know the most that she can know?
You know, I believe, Todd, that for millions of Americans, they have elevated the right to kill an unborn human to the level of a religion. And this is the hill they will die on. This is the one thing they will fight to the end on. And this right to an abortion trumps everything else in their minds, and anything they perceive as a threat to that sacred right, they are going to go ballistic over, and that's what you're seeing here.
Parental notification, what do most of these laws in general require, and how do you respond to the notion that in order for a child, put forth in the New York piece, that in order for a child, and here we are talking about children, to bypass their parents, they'd have to go through a bunch of legal rigmarole, and they're not equipped to do that.
Okay, so the child isn't equipped to go through a legal process, but is equipped to go get an abortion without anybody in her family knowing about it? I mean, talk about a crazy proposition. But beyond that, the author is not being truthful, in my opinion. The way the federal courts have generally applied abortion control legislation to parental notification law at the state level is to say that if the minor can present even a feeling that their parents would not understand, there are judges standing by who are willing to override the parent's right to know and grant a waiver, thus allowing the minor child to get the abortion without the parent's knowledge or consent. This is not a hard thing to do. It's a requirement, but to present it as if it were an impossible thing to achieve, I don't find that persuasive at all.
Here's a quote from near the end of the piece in the New Yorker, and I'd like your response to it. It says, "One reason we've reached this point is that pro-life activists have proved to be tenacious and have made smart use of new technology, those ubiquitous sonograms. And another is that legislators have turned out to have a heartier appetite for shaming and policing women than some of us might have reckoned." What are your thoughts?
Well, notice how this is a question-begging claim. The author would never say that about child abuse laws. She only says it about the human fetus because she's assuming that the fetus is not human like those other children I just referenced. So what you have here is a classic case of assuming the very thing she's trying to prove. And this gets us right to the heart of the debate, Todd. This is not a debate about choice, privacy, trusting women, legal hurdles, or any of the other smokescreens being brought up here. It's about one question: what is the unborn? And that's the question she does not answer.
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute, author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. When you purchase The Case for Life using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and look for The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf. Scott, thank you so much, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., we're going to talk with Professor Tom Egger of Concordia Seminary about Joseph the Patriarch, and we'll discuss Martin Luther on the fruits of false teachers. Dr. Ken Sherb will be our guest. We need to keep our eye on the ball, and the ball is, well, the unborn, the baby in the womb. The question is always relevant whenever discussing whether or not to take the life of that baby. Who is that baby? What is that baby? What is its intrinsic value? That's the question. It's the center of the debate, even if those who debate the other side won't acknowledge it. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper every service every Sunday, preaching Christ crucified and risen, our hope for years to come. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri. Find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.